Hello.
Hi.
Karen Schaum is going to build a labyrinth, probably sometime soon. This was an afterthought to the conversation she'd ended by apologizing for having nothing interesting to say about herself, in which she told me that she lived in a tent and under a parachute in someone's attic, and in a van all up and down the West Coast with a surfer boyfriend while leading wilderness adventures. Despite that Karen describes herself as a yoga devotee, she has very intense eyes. Because of this, I talked too much about my childhood. Our conversation lasted only 20 minutes. Karen's daughters are going to be PE teachers, doctors, artists, or engineers. When she was in high school, Karen's English teacher turned her onto poetry. He brought Larry Levis to read. Karen, I love Larry Levis. Karen has had inappropriate jazz player boyfriends. She came to the University of Montana for graduate school because she loved Richard Hugo and wanted to find herself. She got an MFA, MA, met her husband, and had her first daughter all within the same 2 years. Did she find herself? I don't know, but I will not complain about my workload to Karen. Karen doesn't know how to tell us to be career writers. She thinks that we should make our art an integral part of a life we love. I told her that finding out she was a poet, in addition to an incredibly helpful person who answered all my newbie MFA questions, was like meeting my first grade teacher in a bar, which is dumb. But Karen, I meant that I want to have a drink with you. Karen Schaum still wakes up in the morning and asks herself what she wants to do with her life. She's taught poetry and English in Missoula Public Schools. She's been a student, a drifter, environmental educator, poet. Now she finds art energy invigorating, art energy. She thinks that she only has one more career left in her. I cannot wait to see what that might be. Karen says this, but her eyes still radiate that mysterious dark light. I stuttered again, leaving her office. Bye, see you Sunday. So here we are, and please help me welcome Karen Schaum.
Julie. Turns out Julie's had a few careers too. I don't know if you guys know that she's a painter. And thank you, Beth. What a great story. And BJ and Beth putting Second Wind together has been a great service to all of us. Thank you for coming. Okay, I'm going to read three poems and a poetic prose piece. And I call it that just because I don't really know how to deal with plot. So this first poem is something that can kind of remind us as we go into the sleepy darkness of winter that spring is coming. April alarm. Forsythia pours yellow into a million mini megaphones, the unavoidable music of spring. Luck. We build a bouquet of star-faced iris, tulips, a sprig of lilac from the bush across the alley, the leafy foliage of ninebark. We slip green beans, which are actually purple, into the dirt of the garden and water. My daughter gets lunch, turkey and bread, while I wipe down the table covered in pollen, open the tilting umbrella. We're happy in our world, happy as if we deserve it. The black dog drops her slobbery ball at our feet. The wind picks up between eating and clearing. A simple disagreement about the afternoon turns turgid, silent, then cold. We drive up into the woods, windows closed, and step out into a patch of glacier lilies under ponderosa pines. The fickle spring sun suddenly pours down upon us, standing together, finding each other's hands. We feel it. Christmas flower. And I have to say, this poem is just in here because it has the word penis in it. And my next piece has penis, 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 about 10 times. So this is just to normalize that word. Christmas flower. My mother feels guilty to be bald and still beautiful at 50. So the hospital sends her a poinsettia, a very large and red poinsettia. She's planned ahead for this crisis by buying a salamander silver Miata along with a garage door opener. But the flowers make her even happier. When she calls me over to adjust the leaves or rotate the pot and she's still happy, this poinsettia looks good from all directions. I realize she's given up. A lawsuit would take too long, and the hospital knows this. Everyone's allowed to bow out gracefully on account of the Christmas flower's beauty. The radiologist who pulled my mother's hand onto his penis, saying how much he wanted her each week in his office, will be put on probation again. I'm more concerned about the car now and how I'll pay for it. Okay, this is a piece called Orienteering, and it's kind of old. I dusted it off because I've been tinkering with it for, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 years? And Dee knows about it because she was my EVST chair. I have actually 3 degrees. I also have a Master's of Science in Environmental Studies. And I also thought it might be interesting to you because I wrote it in the first draft in Kittredge's workshop, and some of you are in Kittredge's workshop today. I think he was a lot meaner back then. It's called Orienteering. Whenever I tell this story, I throw in the part about Muhammad Ali, how I met the champion in the Claremont General Hospital after Norton busted up his jaw in 73. I was 8 and remember little of my encounter, but that never stopped me from describing it as one of the central experiences of my life. People seem to like to hear about celebrities. It's as if famous people are the prominent peaks on a topographical map of society. I can point to them, name them, and in the process, attempt to triangulate my own location. I do this because I'm lost. Not physically, but psychically. I'm lost, and I'm looking for a way back into myself. As an outdoor educator in my 20s, I learned one last-ditch effort for finding people who have disappeared in the wilderness, spiraling outwards from their last known location. I've decided to spiral inwards. Any doorway will do. Take the Beatles. Everyone's got a story. Even the cigarette vendors in Liverpool who sold Lennon's first wife her smokes. Mine goes back to Andrew Black, the first journalist ever to interview the Beatles. When Andrew smoked, he let ashes fall on our green shag carpet, which drove my mom crazy. He told stories about John, Paul, George, and Ringo, using words like mug instead of face. Back in England, he'd had a thriving career as a paperback writer, which is why the Beatles wrote a song all about him, and one for his wife, Max, a jeweler. When I asked Andrew if his wife really hit people over the head with a little silver hammer, he said, "Songs don't always tell how things happen, you know?" Dark clouds began to gather the day Andrew arrived. At the airport, we found him sitting horseback on his plaid zip-up suitcase, crooning, "It never rains in California," which sounded more like California, his delicate English mouth. 2 days later, his bravado collapsed as he stood on our porch, peering into the dripping sky. "Looks a wee bit like England," he said with a question in his voice. My older sister Kelly and I nodded our heads up and down, our eyes fixed to the television set. With Mom working nights at the bar, we tried our best to keep Andrew busy, but after the Beatles, there wasn't a whole lot to talk about. Andrew stayed a few weeks at our farm, a white two-story house in Solana Beach, surrounded by avocado orchards and fruit trees on one side, and rows of condominiums on the other. Late at night, I would slip past the chicken coop to empty the trash in the condo dumpsters. From our south-facing, second-story windows, we could see the grandstands of the Del Mar racetrack and a small wedge of the Pacific Ocean. In the other direction, past the ancient bullpine and the Cactus Lady's broken down fence, sat Eden Gardens, a Mexican barrio where my friend Lupe lived with her 6 brothers and sisters, and a shack tucked beneath the canopy of wide-leaf banana trees. Her mother would clean the kitchen floor by sweeping dirt into a hole between the floorboards, then covering the hole back up with a ceramic tile. On Christmas, Lupe's family received boxes of canned goods from St. James Catholic Church, the same church that rented us our farm. We lived in a forgotten land, perched at the end of a dirt road guarded by golden-headed sunflowers. The rutted driveway to our house curved around a small field we used for gardening and grazing. My family raised 2 sheep, mutton I called them, a goat, chickens, turkeys, ducks, guinea fowl, rabbits, a few dogs and cats, and a couple pet cows named Angelina and Stitches. Sometimes we walked the cows on leashes down the coast highway to the beach, joking about the no dogs allowed sign. We liked to break the rules in interesting ways. One story Mom told was that we were better than everyone else because we didn't eat meatloaf with ketchup on Wednesdays, We preferred steak and lobster, or nothing at all. Mostly Kelly and I scavenged the yard for eggs, avocados, Swiss chard, or guavas, a small grayish-green fruit shaped like a hand grenade. This is what we called adventure in my family. Mom liked to bring home strays. Once we had baby skunks living in a cardboard box on the washing machine. Where they came from or where they went, I don't know, but they left their acrid smell behind. I remember a two-week-old lamb with distemper and scabby knees that needed feeding every hour from a warm bottle, so we set an alarm to wake us throughout the night. The lamb died by morning. I had a half-coyote pup named Sage who also caught distemper, but he lived, only to disappear during one of the neighbor's wild shooting sprees. Mom got herself a pistol and slept with it under her pillow. She carried it in her purse. She showed me the gun and let me touch it to help me feel safer, but I didn't. At the beginning of each month, I carried a check, or one of Mom's notes, up the hill to the Monsignor's office. He'd asked me to stand beside his red leather chairs, facing his desk while he penned a response. I usually brought my goat Lucy, short for Lucifer. I'd tie her to the fence where she'd forage along the edge of the gardens. I never felt bad about this, because the Monsignor had his own plans for destruction. He wanted to build a back access road to the church, and add a few terrace parking lots for his parishioners. That meant tearing down our house and the orchards, rearranging the land with bulldozers, backhoes, and pavement. The Monsignor was patient with my family's flexible payment schedule because he intended to evict us as soon as the city gave him the permits. A zoning dispute allowed us to stay for almost 3 years at the farm, from the time I was 11 to 14. The house had beautiful crystal doorknobs, lots of windows, and a funny floor plan with the kitchen and living room upstairs over the garage. Tucked into the side of a hill, my sister's room sat halfway underground. Thick weeds filled Kelly's window, whereas our front door opened out on a landing at the top of a flight of stairs trellised with morning glory vines. Midnight blue blossoms interlaced the green wooden steps and hand railings. When Andrew stayed with us, he'd stand on the landing at the top of the stairs and smoke. He'd snuff out his cigarettes on the wet banister and pinch at the soggy flower heads, lamenting the unusually heavy rains. During one downpour, he retreated to the black Naga hide recliner by the TV and jotted down notes in a three-ring binder. He spoke out loud, describing his ideas for the screenplay he was batting about with Dustin Hoffman. Kelly and I sat propped on either side of the sofa watching Gilligan's Island. God knows we'd seen every episode 10 or 20 times, but I harbored a secret romantic love for Gilligan, the man-child of the 70s. I kept my romantic feelings hidden by feigning disappointment whenever the show came on. Oh, that one again, I'd say, with a callous tone of boredom. I critiqued all the elaborate devices like cars or washing machines, the castaways constructed out of bamboo, palm fronds, and coconuts. I'm sure, I'd say, like they could really make a homing device with just Bowie knives and a radio. My sister and I usually did our homework in front of the TV, but out of deference to Andrew, we held off, making ourselves available for his rambling conversations. During commercials, he'd look at us with a surprisingly docile, "What now?" expression, but we didn't have much to offer. The three of us spent our evenings staring at the fuzzy black and white screen while Andrew's cigarettes burned down in quarter-inch increments. It soon became apparent the original interviewer of the Beatles had nowhere to go and wouldn't be leaving on his own accord. He didn't pay rent and drank Mom's liquor. After a week of flash floods and exactly zero phone calls from Hollywood, Andrew spent his days hibernating downstairs on Kelly's heated waterbed. Refreshed by afternoon slumbers, he'd talk until late at night. I'd nod off as Kelly combed out each strand of her long, dark hair and prepared her makeshift bed on the couch. Once, while sloshing Jack Daniels over the rim of a frosted glass onto his shaking fingers, Andrew bemoaned his choice to leave England. He described his current situation as no less tragic than the breakup of the boys. Mom came home from work at 1 or 2 each morning. Kelly and I woke early, wading through the rising lake in the front yard to feed the cows and the rest of the menagerie. Weekdays, we caught the bus for school early. Andrew tired us out quickly, but Mom let him stay because he was a friend of Jack's. And, as usual, Jack was nowhere to be found. One morning when I was still in the first grade, I looked out my bedroom door in the morning and saw a large, sleepy-eyed man stumbling down our narrow hallway. The stranger wore Mom's terry cloth robe, which barely covered his upper thighs, although when Mom wore it, the thick folds reached down to her calves. He ducked into the bathroom. I heard him peeing for over a minute. When I went in later, I had to pull my sleeve over my nose. Mom introduced the man to Kelly and me as the top 16th heavyweight boxer in the nation, and in a short time, she started calling him our new father. 6'6", Jack sported sideburns and a reddish-brown mustache that dripped off the edges of his jaw. His eyebrows protruded from a thick fold of skin on his forehead, and his chin pointed out like the bow of a rowboat. Mom met Jack at Bully's, the bar and steakhouse where she waited tables. She said he'd ordered 2 full-cut prime ribs, complete with baked potatoes, a pair of dinner salads, and a tub of horseradish, and yet still found room for cheesecake. After dinner, he wiped the grease from his fingers, dropped a $100 tip for the pretty blonde waitress, my mother, and stepped over to the bar to drink until closing. Ever since Mom divorced Dad, she'd had problems with men and money. Bill collectors stood on the front porch shouting at her. Once, an enraged mechanic held a fist up to her face and shook it like he was trying his hardest not to hit her. Scared, I wrote a letter to God, drawing silver-colored angels in the margin. I flung the card over the back fence that divided the apartments from the canyon below. Although I knew better, I sort of expected to see it wrapped up toward heaven. Instead, it slipped down under the thorny bushes below. At the age of 7, I stopped believing in miracles, humiliated every time I passed the weathered paper perched just beyond my reach. Mom, on the other hand, renewed her faith through Jack. Jack bought us a new house in an upscale neighborhood. Mom quit her waitressing job and spent her spare time decorating the new kingdom. Men came to dig up the backyard and put in a black cement swimming pool with a waterfall at the far edge, something from the cover of Sunset Magazine. Since Mom wasn't worried about money, she worried about other things, like my sister's intelligence. Kelly had taken a test that said she was a genius. Mom enrolled us both in private school at La Jolla Country Day, where we wore blazers with golden emblems that said something smart in Latin. We studied algebra and Greek mythology, making friends with children of millionaires, schoolmates who lived in mansions, had live-in maids, and whose parents owned TV dinner conglomerates, car dealerships, or casinos. We mostly rode the bus to and from our new school, but on special occasions, Jack picked us up in his Cadillac. I remember how maroon carpeting ran up the insides of the heavy doors, and each time they opened, little lights went on in the footwells. When they closed, air flattened out behind them. On the day we planned to meet Muhammad Ali, Jack waited for us beneath the budding sycamore trees near the headmaster's office. I let him scoop me into the trunk of his body with his big hands and kiss me with his thick lips, which covered the whole area from my chin to the bottom of my nose, even when he squinched his lips together. He lifted Kelly in the other arm, carrying us side by side. At the hospital, Allie's mouth was stitched shut with wires, so Jack did all the talking. I hung back shyly in the doorway while Kelly stood near a plastic chair, pretending to read the perforation instructions on an unopened box of Kleenex. When my new father held up his hands in half-clenched fists, I thought he wanted to play one potato, two potato with me and the champion. Instead, he turned his back to me and made a quick speech, one heavyweight to another. Norton, not too shabby, uppercut with the left. But you're the champ, side swipe with the right, forever. I kept busy drawing imaginary hopscotch lines around the floor tiles. A black and white checkerboard pattern presented a minor challenge to me, but I hopped my mind successfully through the correct squares, down the hall and back again. Once, when I looked straight at Muhammad Ali, I noticed the whiteness of the gauze surrounding his brown face. Like the floor tiles, I looked past the colors to see the man beneath. At parties, I like to segue a more glorified version of the Ali story into a line about being backstage with the Grateful Dead when I was 11, because my mom went out with a songwriter for the band, or how my stepfather Jack starred in Superman as the big dumb villain. I like to keep moving in order to maintain a sense of mystery. After each punchline, I duck and weave. If asked too many questions, I simply turn the tables with, enough about me, what about you move? When caught in a corner, I have a hard time explaining how the songwriter killed himself and Mom lost her only copy of the tape he made for her, or how Jack hurt his back in the flying machine. Everything gets complicated quickly. Airplanes, I've learned, are not good places to begin impromptu conversations about Ali. Cramped quarters and seatbelts combined with an extremely high altitude make a fast getaway risky. The problem is gravity. Even just the regular standing on the ground type of gravity plays havoc with my insides. Somewhere between my brain and feet is the identity sink where my guts get a funky, turbulent feeling. It starts out as a hard knot that shatters into hundreds of sharp-edged pieces, like eggshells crunching and swirling in an electric garbage disposal without enough water. When I try to make the feeling go away, it only gets worse. For example, in college, I had a hard time writing a paper for my Milton class. I started slipping deep into the identity sink. Instead of taking a little time off, I shaved my head and wandered the neighborhood both bald and naked. People honked their horns. I got dressed and went to my professor's office where I announced, "Samson Agonistes is really getting to me." He took one look at my shiny head, gave me the extension I needed. Sometimes, when I get all caught up in my thoughts, trying to figure everything out, I just have to turn my brain off and go outside. When I was in elementary school, I knew how to do this sort of thing better than I do now. My friends and I would climb through the chaparral-covered hills and wander down to the slough. We'd lose our shoes in the stinky black mud and make rafts out of barrels, the junk lying around in marshes. We'd paddle down to the ocean, capsizing in its rough, salty waters. Then we'd walk along the railroad tracks, daring each other to stand out on the narrow bridge until a train came and everyone scattered. Once we explored an entire section of cement drainage pipe, squirming through a tunnel under Interstate 5 with flashlights and candles. We took turns sticking our heads up the noisy air shaft that opened in the middle of an oleander hedge between north and southbound traffic. On the other side of the freeway, where the wilderness went on for miles, we built forts and scraped out sandstone caves and burrowed endless passageways through the dense chamise, black sage, and wild sumac trees. My best friend Elisa and I took our shirts off when we entered chaparral country. We did this every day until sixth grade, when the knot beneath my left nipple grew noticeably larger. We wore hand-tooled leather belts from Tijuana that we slung our shirts on. Elisa owned a dull knife with a 2-inch nick blade that she kept in a holster on her belt. I coveted it greatly. We both carried corncob pipes in our pockets and smoked dried sage. We ate cactus apples with sticks and made bows and arrows out of green sumac branches, bits of sharp broken glass and yucca fibers. We wanted to be Indians desperately, and if we couldn't be Indians, we wanted to be boys. While Elisa's mom warned us to be careful of black widows, rattlesnakes, and scorpions, my mom cautioned against scraggly hair and torn clothing. She said boys weren't interested in girls who looked raggedy. She dated plenty of men and hinted that her popularity had something to do with the hydrogen peroxide she put in her hair, the way she crimped her eyelashes with a metal tool that opened and closed like a pair of scissors, and the clean chemical smell of her clothes, which she brought home weekly from the dry cleaners. Elise and I looked past her when she said these things, as if the dust settling had infinite more appeal, but her words reached us all the same. Although we wanted to be boys, we weren't immune from wanting to be liked by them as well. At the age of 11, I felt destined to lose on both accounts. To make matters worse, Mom said I took after Dad's Aunt Margaret. It was no secret that any association with my real father, a Lutheran chaplain in the army, was not a compliment. Mom clicked her tongue and shook her head, saying, "You're just going to be another 90-year-old virgin like Margaret, staying home instead of marrying." Of course, staying home was never really an option in my family. Mom moved out to become a flight attendant when I was 14, leaving Kelly and me to pay the rent in the mustard-colored duplex where we lived after the farm. We scraped the money together from the meager child support checks the government automatically deducted from Dad's salary, our jobs at fast food restaurants and cleaning houses, often the homes of our friends from school. Kelly graduated early and went off to college while I lived with friends, then friends of friends, and finally strangers. The summer I turned 16, I visited Kelly at Cornell and disproved the second half of Mom's equation, the part about virginity. Kelly had taught herself to knit, making intricate sweaters during her neurobiology lectures. She claimed busy hands kept her mind focused. Her strategy must have worked, too, because she got A+ on all her exams and the university asked her to be a special research assistant over the summer. She spent long hours at her job castrating hamsters, mashing their tiny gonads in a blender and dabbing the noses of prepubescent female rodents with a crushed testicle mixture, all to prove the obvious that girls develop differently in the presence of male hormones. Young and curious, I had time to experiment on my own. One night while Kelly worked late, I decided to walk down to a bar with a blinking blue neon sign shaped like a dog. The bouncer, a chunky guy in his late 30s named Larry, let me in. After the bar closed, he walked me home. We kissed in my bedroom for a little while before he excused himself to use the bathroom. He stayed there a long time, and I began to worry. When he came back, he didn't say a word. He lay down on top of me, pinning my hips to the bed with his big belly. I got the picture Larry wanted more than kissing, so I tried to reason with him. I thought I said I didn't want to do this. Larry? He showed no interest in negotiating as he reached down and pulled a wad of cotton dress up towards my chin. Scooping my underwear aside, he shifted his weight up onto my belly. Frightened, I lay still as Larry's plastic-covered penis pushed against my inner thigh. His eyes stayed closed the whole time. I didn't scream. In fact, it never occurred to me to cry out, even with my sister sleeping in the other room. Screaming meant losing control, and losing control wasn't an option in my mind. Instead, I heard Mom's voice haranguing me about being a virgin for the rest of my life, and I decided, just as Larry put the full weight of his prodding hips behind his stiff penis, that losing my virginity to a balding bouncer I didn't know or even like was something I should want to do. I didn't cry, even when he felt like a burning tree turning inside me. After he finished, Larry asked if I liked it. I had the nerve to say no, so he made a show of having his feelings hurt. He decided we should try again because sex was supposed to be enjoyable, and he was certainly enjoying himself. Something must just be wrong with you, he chuckled. I lay on the soft mattress with my legs open, letting him push into me all over again. My body moved up and down, up and down, up and down, until finally he finished and crawled off of me. A bunch of pennies fell from his pants when he rolled over to pull them up. He left a small pile of spare change, a gooey condom, and a spot of blood in the bed as souvenirs for me. Let me try again. When I was 8, I sensed Allie's importance because Mom invited him and his wife to dinner. She wanted to boil lobsters and make a red sauce that took 2 days to cook. I don't think she ever got over it, not making Muhammad Ali lobster. When Mrs. Ali refused, saying she didn't care to eat with white people, Mom told the story over and over, mincing the words white people on the phone in grocery store aisles down at Bully's where she started working again when Jack's fighting career took a dive. In the end, it didn't really matter if the Allies turned down her dinner invitation because Muhammad got his jaw busted and couldn't chew for months. Jack took the third mortgage out on the house without telling anyone, disappearing days before men came to put our furniture out on the streets. Jack didn't have time to collect all his things before he disappeared. He left what Mom called the boner bomb, a pipe made out of green stone and wood. The stone part looked like the knobby end of a bone. The wooden part, shaped like the tip of a penis, had a hole for sucking on. Mom kept the boner bong in the living room, wrapped inside a black sock. It sat on a low shelf next to her matchbox collection, in a bronze container full of pot, mostly stickweed, but I didn't know any better back then. I was 9 when I started smoking pot. I didn't mind doing it with just Mom and Kelly, but I didn't like her friends. Once Jack left, Mom had 2 or 3 new guys hanging around. I didn't like it when they tried to talk to me and my mouth got all cottony. I had a miniature collie, not the yappy kind, but a good-natured, quiet sort of dog. Mom called him Tippy after her childhood pup, and I loved him so much that I let him go everywhere with me except school. Tippy slept on the pillows of my bed at night. When I fed him celery or banana pieces to see if he still loved me, he swallowed every bite. He would walk devotedly back and forth beneath my outstretched hand when I didn't feel like petting him. Sometimes I dressed Tippy up in stretchy shorts and knotted t-shirts. I made him do jumping tricks and run in tight circles. I laughed at the way he looked, but I never felt good about Mom getting him stoned. She'd hold Tippy down and blow smoke into his mouth until he couldn't fight her anymore. He'd finally conk out under the stairs next to the piano, hardly able to lift his panting nose off his paws. Mom would laugh as if Tippy were the funniest thing in the whole world. I'd laugh too, although my heart just wasn't in it. Sometimes when I couldn't talk or swallow, she and her friends would laugh at me. Mom never forced me to do anything. One night while smoking pot, she said, "Just try it," as if she'd put a new vegetable on my dinner plate. Another thing that made me uncomfortable as a kid was when Jack rubbed his penis up against me when the whole family swam naked at night. He held me close in the pool as if he were giving me a hug. With the black cement and the lights out, nothing could be seen below the surface. Mostly had to make sure Mom didn't see. With her, he could squeeze her breasts or lick her face, but he wasn't allowed to do these things with Kelly or me because he was our new father. Sometimes Jack took me to work with him. We'd jump rope together at the gym. I played with my dolls while he hit the punching bag and sparred with the other boxers. He wore stretchy bands around his wrists and forehead to catch the streams of sweat. One morning, Jack touched me down between my legs. I could hear Kelly in the other room watching cartoons, and I imagined myself in front of Scooby-Doo instead of in the bedroom with my new father as he inched his big sweaty hands up my feet to my thighs and higher still. He kept pushing his thumbs up between my legs, opening the hole down there wider and wider. It wasn't like the pool where I could swim away and pretend nothing had happened. I just lay still, counting the mountains and the cottage cheese plaster ceiling and listening to Scooby howl. My mind felt like a pinprick of light out on the dark ocean. It felt like a small boat weighted down with sand, sinking deeper and deeper. In my head, I kept repeating, "This is wrong, wrong, wrong." Once Mom drove south with Kelly and me across the border into Baja. We went to a beach where she laid out her blanket on the side of a hill and slept in the sun for a couple hours, while my sister and I made castles, swam in the breakwater, and played jump rope with seaweed. In the background, we heard motorcycles, but the beach was otherwise empty. After hours of lying in one place, Mom suddenly got up and moved her blanket. Everything about the spot felt wrong to her. Minutes later, a motorcycle flew over the top of the dune and landed exactly where she had been sleeping. Sometimes wrong can be a very precise sensation.